Thank you very much. I want to begin by thanking Kim Kerrigan and Connie Eichenlaub, who's backstage somewhere, and Wes Baker, who just introduced me, did the honors for us. And there's Deborah and Ben and Richard and Ia and Roger, that's Roger Herbst, and Michael. These are all people with the Seattle 9/11 Visibility Project, and I really thank them. They have worked very hard and very effectively for the events for last evening and this evening. They've just done a terrific job. Yeah, they really deserve that. And it's a privilege also, I say that, it's corny but true, to be here, to work with these folks and with my dear friend Webster Tarpley, whom I so much admire. And it's really a privilege to be with each and every one of you. Life doesn't get much better than when we gather freely together as citizens to discuss important matters and try to forge a better future, a kinder, saner, more peaceful future. That's what we're doing here tonight, in my opinion, and it is really a privilege for all of us to do that. It's a right and not a privilege for us citizens who in any country are sovereign to assemble, to speak publicly, to organize, to demonstrate, and to lobby our legislative representatives, all without fear. And if those representatives become corrupt, we have the right, in fact, we have a duty to replace them. And I hope I'm speaking for many here when I say we're fortunate to have with us tonight a terrific, down-to-earth, earth-friendly, war-unfriendly, patriotic potential replacement for a corrupt sitting senator. And I refer to Mark Wilson. Mark, take a bow. I had the privilege of meeting Mark only yesterday, but I'm mightily impressed. The final privilege I want to acknowledge is the amazing privilege of just being alive at this time in the planet's history. If we were meeting, just say, 150 years ago with our horses tethered outside, consider how relatively powerless we'd be. We would not have the power to instantly be in touch with events, individuals, and ideas from around the world. We would not have the power to access most of the knowledge accumulated by our species. And it's a knowledge base that's growing exponentially. Each of us today has far more knowledge power than any king in history ever had. We are privileged, but we are in danger. We must quickly increase our grasp of history. We must learn more, faster than ever before, about the mistakes repeatedly made by our species, mistakes we can and should read about in books such as Collapse by Jared Diamond, and the slim but powerful book A Short History of Progress by Ronald Wright, which I can't too highly recommend. Now, in the past, speaking engagements, I have regrettably bored some members of some audiences by going into detail about these mistakes that have been made down through history. So I condensed my view of history into 10 minutes. But now I've got it down to 75 seconds. Okay? So here's my view of history in 75 seconds. Early societies, cooperative, based on caring and sharing. Religions get established, very problematical. Technology develops. Many advances turn out to be progress traps. Example, irrigation ruins land through salinization. Priests become kings. Kings learn best way to mobilize and control people is through war. Kings learn to make sure there's always an enemy, and if your enemy won't oblige, surest pretext for wars is false flag operations. Warrior class becomes self-perpetuating. Kings subjugate and steal from their own. Life is struggle, struggle, struggle. Societies move to stabbing and grabbing. Nature becomes neglected, then abused. Civilization after civilization breaks down through environmental collapse. New civilizations, more complex. Wealthiest at top form anti-democratic oligarchies. Continues as ruling system today. system also neglects and abuses nature on a larger scale. Oligarchies expand their power. Members enjoy immense unearned riches long after environmental degradation sets in and people begin suffering. Concentration of power and wealth at the top now grotesque. Members of oligarchy clearly dinosaurs. Most visible one, Bushosaurus rex. Whole system becomes House of Cards, otherwise known as today's world. Planet dying, top TV show, American Idol. Now, I am reading tonight because it's a brand new presentation for me, and Webster and others saying, yes, just wing it. I'm sorry. I'm not going to wing it. I'm going to try to go with what I prepared. 6 points leading to 9/11. One, we're in the greatest crisis in history, a multi-dimensional crisis, the most dangerous dimension being environmental. We are quickly destroying the Earth's life support systems. Of that, there's abundant evidence. There are crises in health and justice, poverty and inequity, amidst a growing economic crisis, all building like earthquake pressures. Second, crisis is a powerful teacher. Jalaluddin Rumi, the Sufi mystic, said, "To increase your knowledge, increase your necessity." Our necessity is being increased for us. When Time magazine publishes an apology that it was slow to understand the truth about global climate change, that's something. Crisis wakes up people who otherwise would not wake up and provides people already awake with teachable moments. Third, we are powerful. Not least among our obstacles is a lack of sufficient faith in ourselves, however, our timidity. As Arthur C. Clarke put it, the worst failures are failure of imagination and failure of nerve. Not least does this apply, in my opinion, to the crisis of constitutional democracy in these United States. We must imagine how bad things could become, and we must imagine how good they could become. Fourth, grave responsibility rests on our shoulders. If we fail to take adequate actions, the forces causing environmental destruction, war, poverty, and injustice leading to fascism will continue to consolidate. If a total fascist coup is imposed, it will be too late. It will be Hitler, but with no allies to come and save us. And they're building the detention centers now. Fifth, the sovereign citizens in any country cannot trust their oligarchies with their welfare, let alone that of humankind and the planet. The time for blind faith in authority is utterly over and done with. The time for the majority of people to reassert their inalienable sovereignty has inescapably returned. Essentially, we wake up or die. Sixth, the key politically relevant event that continues to suffuse all is 9/11. It's key in the sense that it is the most brazen war-triggering false flag operation so far in history, and there have been many. It's also key in that it is the linchpin for the so-called war on terrorism, no end date given. This so-called war is the evil bedrock for the rolling fear campaign designed to silence people, maintain and expand the powers of the oligarchies, and fund obscene and growing militarism. 9/11 is the ace card the oligarchy keeps playing. Webster notes that Karl Rove has said his strategy for the coming elections is that the Democrats are the pre-9/11 party and the Republicans are the post-9/11 party. It's that central. Waking up the general citizenry to the true nature of 9/11 and who was behind it can scuttle Karl's plans, dislocate the linchpin, and open the door through a period of chaos to a safer, saner future. Now, what I'd like to do with the rest of my time is tackle four areas. One is the evidence about 9/11. Then I'd like to discuss the subject of denial, why people find ways to avoid looking at the evidence. Then I'd like to look at media censorship. And then what can we do? Now, on evidence, two persuaders battle on the fields of 9/11. The first is the official story, and it was put into play the day of 9/11. It's the story of the crazed Arab terrorist hijackers who fly planes into Billings. And seemingly backing up that story were images of planes indeed flying into buildings. Iconic images we'll never be able to erase from our memory banks. Now, stories are powerful and easy to remember. We're suckers for stories. The essence of every story, writes American two-time Pulitzer Prize winner John Ferry in his book, wonderful book, Writing for Story. The essence of every story is that, quote, a sympathetic character encounters a complication. That's at the center of every story. Now, in the official 9/11 storyline, America is the sympathetic character. Fighting a rearguard action against the official story is evidence. Evidence that the official story is a fiction that leads to another story, much less known, much more explosive, much more difficult, White House complicity. In this alternative story, the sympathetic character is that part of America that wants to turn away from militarism, corruption, resource theft, and lawlessness. We pay lip service to evidence, but generally we arrange evidence to fit whatever story we're adhering to. The story that has already persuaded us. A great deal of evidence has been assembled that 9/11 was an inside job. And I was going to show a picture of my forthcoming book, but I couldn't get the slide to work. And in that book, Towers of Deception, 9/11 and the Media Cover-Up, which should be out in mid-August, I present the evidence in the form of 26 exhibits, A to Z. But before we look at just a couple of them, we need to think for a moment about the nature of evidence. In David Ray Griffin's book, The New Pearl Harbor, David Ray Griffin distinguishes between cumulative and deductive arguments. And I found this extremely useful. Now, apply it to 9/11. With 9/11, only one exhibit of evidence needs to be proven true beyond reasonable doubt to show that 9/11 was an inside job. Now, that's important to remember. Because after that, if there's a second piece of evidence that proves beyond reasonable doubt that 9/11 was an inside job, it consolidates that theory. And if more than one holds up, it becomes stronger still. And if a clear majority holds up, the case becomes invincible. But what if one exhibit fails to hold up under cumulative? Does this mean all the others are undermined or rendered null and void? No. It means that particular evidence can be set aside for further scrutiny. It can turn out to be entirely wrong, but this does not undermine the other pieces of evidence. Each piece of evidence needs to be examined on its own merits, and each bona fide exhibit on its own supports the cumulative evidence of an inside job on 9/11. Now, as David Ray Griffin points out, support for the official story of 9/11, on the other hand, involves deductive reasoning. Now, in deductive reasoning, each step in the argument depends upon the truth of the previous step. For example, to logically believe in the official story, you have to believe there were 19 kamikaze Arab hijackers who outsmart the $30 billion a year U.S. intelligence apparatus and hijack four commercial airliners all at once, and outwit NORAD, the FAA, and the U.S. Air Force, and fly the airliners with pinpoint accuracy into the Twin Towers and the Pentagon, and thus bring the towers down, a first in architectural history, and that this was all orchestrated by Osama bin Laden and some other members of Al-Qaeda. With deductive reasoning, the truth of each part of the official story is essential to hold the whole story up. For instance, if there's no credible evidence that the 19 individuals the White House claims boarded the airliners actually did so, the rest of the official narrative is seriously damaged and would collapse in a court of law. Because in deductive reasoning, the whole chain can fail if one link fails. Okay, now let's go on to a couple of the exhibits in my book. I mean, many people have brought forward these exhibits in many books, and my book is not aimed at providing evidence so much, it's aimed at the media. But with World Trade Center Building 7, this is World Trade Center Building 7, which was a 47-story steel-framed skyscraper. And the evidence is that it was wired in advance for controlled demolition. Building number 7 fell down at 5:20 p.m. on 9/11 into its own footprint all of a sudden. It had not been damaged by the events earlier in the day. It was not hit by an airplane. And as you'll see, I think, there were only two small fires burning in building number 7. Now, under the official story, building 7 would have been demolished by Osama bin Laden. and his Al-Qaeda co-conspirators. So when you demolish a building, you've got to get into it and do a lot of technical stuff for a couple or 3 weeks in advance. So one would wonder, why would Osama spend these resources to bring down this particular building and risk so much, and what would be his purpose in doing that? But another thing is, if Osama did bring down Building 7, there's coming down, if he actually brought down Building 7, then why wouldn't the White House make a big deal about that, as they did about the Twin Towers? And why would the media make it virtually a non-building? And why would the 9/11 Commission not even mention that that building fell down on 9/11? Those are questions that are in fact evidence of an inside job and of a cover-up. Now, some have argued, believe it or not, one of them is Gerald Posner, don't know if anybody knows him, that tanks of diesel fuel in the basement, or alternately on floor 5, or alternatively on floor 7, the tanks of diesel fuel in Building 7 caught fire and caused the collapse. Now, the problem with this is that there's no evidence of such a large fire. No one can point to any photographic evidence of such a large fire. And also there's the fact that even if the whole building was completely covered with flaming diesel fuel, it would not bring down a steel-framed high-rise. No one has ever said they smelled diesel fuel that day. According to FEMA, the notion that diesel fuel leak burned and heated the building's steel supports to the point of failure, quote, has only a low probability of occurrence. And FEMA's final report on Building 7 collapse comes to no specific conclusion. Now, those are the little fires earlier in the day in Building 7. There's Larry Silverstein. Now, he's the owner of the building, and he said on a PBS documentary in September 2002 that he suggested to the New York City Fire Department commander that they pull the building. Pull is an industry term meaning to demolish. Now, here were his exact words on PBS. He said, "I remember getting a call from the fire department commander telling me they were," this is how he talks, "telling me they were not sure they were going to be able to contain the fire, and so I said, we've had such a terrible loss of life. Maybe the smartest thing to do is to pull it. And they made that decision to pull, and we watched the building collapse." That's the owner of the building. He said that. Now, he didn't mention anything about diesel fuel. Now, on September the 9th, 2005, Silverstein, indirectly, he didn't do it himself, issued a clarification of what he meant by pull it. And he said, through an intermediary, that he meant it was to remove a contingent of firefighters remaining in the building. However, since he did not mention any firefighters in his original statement, and since there's proof that there were no firefighters in the building at the time it collapsed, it seems that his statement is questionable. Now, relevant to the issue of government conspiracy on 9/11 is the fact that Building 7 effectively was a military building. The CIA, somebody's asking about it, had a clandestine bunker on the 25th floor. The Secret Service was there. The Department of Defense had offices there. And, of course, Mayor Giuliani, 1 year before, had ordered the establishment of a state-of-the-art Office of Emergency Management, which was built there, had its own separate water supply, own separate air supply, and it had windows that would withstand 160-mile-an-hour winds. Now, that would have been the perfect place from which to operate on the day of New York City's greatest emergency ever. But they abandoned the control center. They just left it. Now, you saw that earlier slide, that one. That's one of the World Trade Center towers under construction. And in the center there, you can see what, in fact, is, if you count them, 47 gigantic vertical steel supports. These were among the strongest buildings ever built. And there's a man named Kevin Ryan, who was site manager of the Environmental Health Laboratories, which certified the steel components used in construction of the World Trade Center. And he wrote an open letter to a government scientist, Frank Gale, of the National Institute of Standards and Technology, known as NIST. And he questioned an October 19, 2004 report by NIST that fuel fires caused this tower and the other tower to collapse. And his letter, Ryan's letter, pointed out that steel in towers tested up to its certified standard and would easily withstand the temperatures caused by burning jet fuel. He's a chemist by profession. Ryan said he was acting in the hope of receiving a public response from Gale. Given the impact of September 11th on events around the world, Ryan wrote, "Everyone needs to know the full truth of what really happened on that day." 1 week later, Ryan was fired. Ryan later wrote, "The three World Trade Center buildings in question weren't all designed the same way and weren't all hit by airplanes. The only thing they seemed to have in common were relatively small and manageable fires. From the government's report, we know that only a small percentage of the supporting columns in each of the first two buildings were severed and that the jet fuel burned off in a few minutes." And he continues, "To follow the latest leading hypothesis from NIST, which are at odds what are the odds, he asked, "that all the fireproofing fell off in just the right places, even far from the point of impact?" Because NIST had said that fireproofing dropped off, and that's why the steel was more vulnerable to being heated to the point of failing. And he went on, "Without much test data, let's say it's 1 in 1,000. That's the chance of all the fireproofing falling off in all the right places. And what are the odds that the office furnishings converged to supply highly directed and somehow forced oxygen fires at the very precise points on the remaining columns? Is it another 1 in 1,000? What is the chance that those points would then all soften in unison and give way perfectly so that the highly dubious progressive global collapse theory could be born? Finally, what are the chances that the first, second, and third incidents of fire-induced collapse would all occur on the same day? Let's say it's 1 in 1,000,000. Considering everything, we're looking at a 1 in 1,000,000,000 chance." Now, NIST said that it was fire that brought down the towers. The aircraft hitting them, NIST did not claim, knocked them over or something, or weakened them sufficiently. NIST said it was the fire. In 1988, there was a blaze in the first Interstate Bank building in Los Angeles, and it raged for 3.5 hours and gutted 4.5 of the building's 62 floors. There was no significant structural damage. In 1991, a huge fire in Philadelphia's One Meridian Plaza lasted for 18 hours and gutted 8 of the building's 38 floors. But, said a FEMA report, although, quote, "beams and girders sagged and twisted under severe fire exposures, the columns continued to support their loads without obvious damage." In 2004, a fire in a 50-story building in Caracas, Venezuela, raged for 17 hours, gutting the building's top 20 floors, yet the building did not collapse. The slide you just saw was the Edificio Windsor in Madrid, which in 2005 turned into a raging inferno for 17 hours. That was on February the 12th, with only the top floors partially collapsing. And this building is not exactly comparable to the World Trade Center towers in that it was built of reinforced concrete, but the World Trade Center towers, being steel-framed, were stronger than that. This building did not collapse. And that's the Caracas one. So these fires in Los Angeles, Philadelphia, and Caracas were hot enough to break windows. In the World Trade Center towers, they were not. NIST claimed the towers collapsed because the planes knocked fireproofing off the steel columns. If this has validity, it should apply to the Philadelphia and Caracas buildings. The steel in those buildings was directly exposed to raging fires for 14 or more hours, and yet the steel did not buckle. So Kevin Ryan wrote another letter to Frank Gale, and he didn't receive any satisfaction. So, actually, one could go on. By the way, the steel debris from the World Trade Center buildings, all three of them, was illegally, contrary to federal law, removed from a crime scene and shipped overseas to China and India to be melted down into paper clips. So what we're supposed to be discussing here now is denial. I want to go on to denial. Now, in my book, there's a chapter on what's usually called denial. Going deeper into that is threatening, really, for most of us, because it's threatening that part of us that believes that we're in control of our consciousness, that we are captains of our thoughts. And it's an ongoing human conceit that we are. And we pay a price if we don't explore this conceit. But knowledge about how we really function can help us be more humble, yes, and maybe less prone to mistakes. And it can help us understand others better. Why, when we are presenting them with evidence like you've just seen, they can be so obstinate about evading it and come up with all sorts of rationalizations why this evidence is invalid. Now, Steven Pinker, in his latest book called The Blank Slate, The Modern Denial of Human Nature, writes that the unified self is an illusion. And as you think about that a bit, we all really know that. You know, you say, I'm at war with myself, or I'm of two minds, and so on. So we know we're not a unified self, really, but normally we go around thinking we are. And he builds on new research into the two hemispheres of our brains. The left is the so-called logical, rational, intellectual side, and the right is the so-called artistic, pattern-recognizing, emotional side. Now, once in a while, surgeons have to cut something called the corpus callosum, which joins the two hemispheres. And it literally cuts the self in two. And it's found, after that has happened, person doesn't die or anything, it's found that each hemisphere can exercise free will without the other one's advice or consent. Now, disconcertingly, what is found in those cases is that the left hemisphere constantly weaves a coherent but false account of the behavior chosen without its knowledge by the right. So they are in fact connected, but they're not connected by the main cable. British medical journalist Rita Carter, in her book Mapping the Mind, addresses the same phenomenon. The idea, she says, that our actions may be irrational is peculiarly unacceptable to the left hemisphere. A series of famous experiments, she writes, show that people hardly ever admit to making arbitrary decisions. In one of the experiments, for example, a selection of nylon stockings was laid out and a group of women were invited to choose a pair. When they were asked why they had made their particular choice, all the women were able to give detailed and sensible reasons, citing slight differences in color, texture, or quality. In fact, all the stockings were identical. The women's reasons for choosing them were actually rationalizations constructed to explain an essentially inexplicable piece of behavior. And the spooky part, Pinker writes, is that we have no reason to think that the baloney generator in the left hemisphere of patients whose corpus callosum has been cut is behaving any differently than our baloney generator as we make sense of the inclinations emanating from the rest of our brains. He says, the conscious mind is a spin doctor, not the commander in chief. Now, Pinker might as well refer also to the stories that are planted in our brains, like the story of 9/11, that powerful story. And in an article entitled Why Bad Beliefs Don't Die, in the Skeptical Inquirer magazine, November-December 2000, a psychologist, Gregory W. Lester, points out that, quote, because beliefs are designed to enhance our ability to survive, our brains are biologically designed to be strongly resistant to change. Actually, I've read several books on this, and they all say the same thing. When data and belief come into conflict, the brain does not automatically give preference to data. This is why beliefs, even bad beliefs, irrational beliefs, silly beliefs, crazy beliefs, often don't die in the face of contradictory evidence. The brain is extremely reticent to jettison its beliefs. And a stunning example is the story I mentioned to you about diesel fuel having caused Building 7 to fall down. But you know the psychological trouble we're in, and therefore the challenge faced by those of us striving to introduce evidence into the national dialogue about 9/11 is even greater. It's even worse than that presented by Pinker and Carter and Lester and others. Recent American research shows that we derive positive pleasure from irrationally sticking with beliefs against evidence. Some of you may have seen this story. The research was done at Emory University and was presented this past January to the Society for Personality and Social Psychology in Palm Springs, California. It showed, quote, there are flares of activity in the brain's pleasure centers when unwelcome information is being rejected. Dr. Drew Weston, a psychologist and the lead author of the study, said, activity spiked in the circuits involved in reward, a response similar to what addicts experience when they get a fix. The study points to a total lack of reason in political decision-making. None of the circuits involved in conscious reasoning were particularly engaged, Weston said. Liberals and conservatives can become equally bug-eyed and irrational when talking politics, especially when they are on the defensive. The cold reasoning regions of the cortex were relatively quiet. For partisans, political thinking is often predominantly emotional. It's possible to override these biases, Dr. Weston said, but you have to engage in ruthless self-reflection and say, all right, I know what I want to believe, but I have to be honest. He added, it speaks to the character of the discourse that this quality is rarely talked about in politics. And there's a wonderful guy, Steve Behrman, otherwise known as Swami Beyondananda. And in his latest book, Swami for President, he's a great guy for wordplay, he said he actually met a person who said to him, I know what you say is true, but I still don't believe it. Now, into this discouraging, if sometimes entertaining, mix, we must introduce another element, and that is simply interests. The brain of a person whose livelihood derives largely or wholly on the belief in a particular story or worldview will be rationalizing on steroids to protect that story or worldview. Say someone's involved in the military and works in an arms factory or in government in general. So intellect is at the service of interests to a disappointing extent. This muddle of factors determining our beliefs about 9/11 should be kept in mind when we're talking with family, friends, neighbors, and colleagues about 9/11. Our best chance is to try to understand what they think is fact. What is their worldview? What values do they think are at issue? And what interests are at stake for them? Openings to share the truth as we see it, I'm sort of assuming here that we're more or less united or homogenous in this respect. That's not quite true, but I'll go along with it. It suits me to rationalize that way. It suits my interests. openings to share the truth as we see it will tend to appear. And for instance, if security is a big issue for someone, a discussion as to whether 9/11 increased or decreased, say, domestic security could be fruitful. If a person is patriotic but values honesty in government, trying to find out which ranks higher in that person's value system and then relating that to the lies of 9/11 could be a useful discussion. So we're moving on to another section, to the third of my 4 points, which I don't have title slides for, censorship by the media. Now, journalists are not outside the overarching sense of reality shared by most people. And what is the reality, anyway, of world events? Nowadays, more than ever, it is a synthetic perceptual reality fashioned in each person's brain heavily from inputs from the instantaneous global infosphere. And often beknown, rightly, is the establishment propaganda pouring out of newsrooms. But it should be remembered that it pours into newsrooms, too, and that journalists are immersed in it, and it has its cumulative effect there. Increasingly, what Webster calls overdetermined reality is the product of covert agents working for invisible governments, creating false flag operations that the media report as simple reality. It's a pretty difficult situation. One example is the incubator baby murders allegedly carried out by Iraqi soldiers during Iraq's 1990 invasion of Kuwait. And the mainstream media uncritically bought, and the world believed, the emotional testimony of a 15-year-old girl who was testifying at a congressional hearing room in Washington, D.C., who said that babies were thrown on the cold concrete floor to die, and she really was choked up. It was a very emotional bit of testimony. And it was said that she could not be identified for fear of reprisals. She said she had seen this with her own eyes. And the testimony helped to sway the U.S. public in favor of a land war against Iraq, Operation Desert Storm, as you remember. Up to that point, the American public was split about 50-50 on whether the United States should engage in a land war there. And after this girl's testimony, and there was a couple of other pieces of disinformation introduced in the infosphere at the same time, such as alleged satellite photographs of huge numbers of tanks gathering on borders, the American public's support for land war zoomed. I think it went up to 80% or something. Well, it turned out that Canadian Broadcasting Corporation investigative team, that the girl was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the U.S. And she was coached in acting by the giant U.S. public relations firm Hill & Knowlton. And it was a $10 million joint White House-Kuwaiti conspiracy, actual conspiracy of deception. Now, within the media, there's a natural tendency to turn away from consideration that corruption could be so profound and so high up, that deception could be so brazen and intentions so murderous that it would actually exist. And I've heard otherwise well-informed journalists say, and I imagine all of you, or most of you, have heard various people say this, maybe you've said it yourself, I just don't want to go there. So there's kind of a looking at and a looking away at the same time. And then there's the study required. Supposing a journalist decides to pursue this difficult topic, probably against the, with his or her colleagues looking askance, think of the study that is required to follow the money or the contradictions, to look into the abyss. And then there's the fear of being wrong. And if all the other newspapers and television channels haven't tackled this head on, well, they must have a reason. So everybody thinks that, and nobody does anything. And there are fears of stepping out of line, of being laughed at, of losing out on a promotion, facing a demotion, being seen as a conspiracy nut. On and on go the interlaced fears, nonetheless real, for sometimes being half-conscious or totally acknowledged. And there's a still relevant quote by George Orwell that was in 1984 about doublethink. And here's the quote. Orwell said, and he was speaking about journalists, I do believe, wasn't he? I think he was. He wrote, the process has to be conscious, or it would not be carried out with sufficient precision. But it also has to be unconscious, or it would bring with it a feeling of falsity and hence of guilt. To tell deliberate lies while genuinely believing in them, to forget any fact that has become inconvenient, and then, when it becomes necessary again, to draw it back from oblivion just for so long as it's needed, to deny the existence of objective reality, and all the while to take account of the reality which one denies, all this is indispensably necessary. And that's what he means by doublethink. It's really not a simple thing. Now, a surprise, to move from the mainstream media to the alternative media, so-called alternative media, or left media, progressive media. A surprisingly large number of the left media outlets, most of them in fact, have adopted the same stance of Noam Chomsky, and he's on that slide. Chomsky obstinately refuses to investigate the evidence about 9/11. And he actually discourages or ridicules those who do. And most of the left media wind up using the worn-out and intellectually bankrupt, put-down phrase, wacky conspiracy theorist, to describe others on the left who want to discuss the evidence of an inside job on 9/11. The almost total uniformity within the left media, in sync with actually the White House and the right media, is more than puzzling. Because otherwise, left media pursue questions of malfeasance on the part of the power elites, including some conspiracies such as Iran-Contra. Now, individuals and media outlets that have exhibited this stay away from 9/11 stance for more than 4 years now include David Korn and The Nation, Amy Goodman of Democracy Now!, Chip Burlett, senior analyst at the Political Research Associates in Somerville, Mass., David Barsamian of Alternative Radio, Michael Albert of Zed Magazine, Alexander Coburn, Norman Solomon, The Progressive, Mother Jones, Alternet, Global Exchange, PBS, South End Press, Public Research Associates, Fair Extra, Counterspin, The Columbia Journalism Review, Deep Dish TV, Working Assets, Molly Ivins, Ms. Magazine, Interpress Service, Move On, Greg Palast, and Ward Churchill. None of them will say a peep about 9/11 except to claim that anybody who wants to look at the evidence is a conspiracy theorist. Now, of course, different people can independently or through dialogue arrive at the same or similar conclusions on any subject. But at the same time, it's a startling anomaly that so many organs and leaders of the conscious left seem to be unconscious about 9/11. And more than a few on the left share the opinion of progressive filmmaker Roy Harvey of Northern New York State, who says that he believes that the greatest single obstacle to the spread of 9/11 truth is the left media. Because, you know, all those media, they put together, they have a huge influence. That the agenda of Chomsky and Barsamian and all the rest would be so widespread and pursued with such intensity begs explanation. One theory would be coincidental incompetence, almost like the incompetence theory about 9/11 itself. That for some reason all these thinkers, editors, producers, and writers have just lost their curiosity and forgotten how to use the tools of their trade at the same time right after 9/11. There are other theories. The situation brings to mind the line from The Sign of Four by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Whenever you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. Now, there are other explanations for the near-uniform 9/11 blindness on the part of left leaders and left media. They include the fact that increasingly, these left media seek and receive funding from the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Endowment, there it is, the Schuman Foundation, the Kaplan Foundation, and George Soros. Bob Feldman of San Francisco has been a tireless researcher of left foundation connections, and his articles paint a picture rarely mentioned because both left and right have an interest in keeping quiet about it. This chart shows recent money flows from establishment foundations to left media. And in a recent article for Critical Sociology entitled Report from the Field, Left Media and Left Think Tanks, Foundation Managed Protest? Question mark. Feldman begins, left media and left think tank staff people generally deny that the acceptance by their organization of grants from liberal foundations has transformed their organizational priorities, subjected them to elite control, or channeled their energies into safe, legalistic, bureaucratic activities and mild reformism. However, 5,000 words and dozens of charts later, he concludes, there is much evidence that the funded left has moved towards the mainstream as it has increased its dependence on foundations. And this is shown by the progressive reformist tone of formerly radical organizations, the gradual disappearance of challenges to the economic and political power of corporate America and militarism and imperialism, and silence on the relationship of the liberal foundations to either politics and culture in general or to their own organizations. And specifically on the subject of 9/11, some subtle inducements and pressures on left media by right-wing and CIA-connected foundations have come to light. For instance, Deep Dish TV, Inc. was given $75,000 in 2002 by the Ford Foundation to enable the television news series Democracy Now! To, quote, continue incorporating the aftermath of the September 11th attacks into future broadcasts. Now, is Emmanuel Seferius here? Are you here, Eman? No, he's not. Anyway, he's from Seattle. And Eman, he dug into this a couple of years ago about the foundation funding of the left, and he commented at the time, because he was in touch with Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! To try to get Democracy Now! To cover the 9/11 situation. And he said in an email, they never told us a reason that Democracy Now! Refused to consider any programming about 9/11. But it's quite simple. The Ford Foundation, by supplying so much money to Democracy Now! So they can, quote, continue incorporating 9/11 into their broadcasts, does not have to explicitly tell Democracy Now! How they want 9/11 to be covered. Democracy Now! Will simply self-censor because they want future money from the Ford Foundation. So, finally, what to do? It's important, nevertheless, to nurture alternative media which do nurture us. Now, alternative media nowadays need encouragement to pay serious and continuing attention to the 9/11 truth issue. The Winnipeg-based progressive magazine Canadian Dimension decided to publish what turned out to be a 2.5-page review of the best material about 9/11 after just one reader bugged them to pay attention to the issue. And alternative media that resist paying serious attention to 9/11 need to be lobbied heavily now. It's past time for them to be called to account. Actually, they're easier to reach than the mainstream, you know? That job is up to existing subscribers and reporters in the main. Alternative media that adamantly resist publishing questions about the 9/11 official story then need to lose subscription and other support from anyone concerned about the truth of 9/11. Because, you know... Yeah. A great deal of what we need to know, we can probably find out on the internet and through all our networks of friends and everything. And most of what Noam Chomsky says about U.S. imperialism, you can easily find all out all over the place. You don't need him to tell you about it anymore. But so don't give up on the mainstream. Cultivate contacts if you can. Become a resource. And the recent interest in 9/11 truth at Como is a hopeful bit of evidence. And I believe Tim Brown from Como is here tonight filming again. And this is typical that when there's interest in a mainstream outlet on, well, any controversial subject, you know, politically controversial subject, it's usually because one or maybe one or two people, editors, reporters or whatever, who are genuine, have good credibility inside the organization, become what's called in business a champion for that subject. And they say, we should be covering it. And they have respect, and so something can happen. And these are very valuable people. Fortunately, I had that own experience when I was at Vision TV and decided way early in December of 2001 to go on national television in Canada and seriously question the official story of 9/11. And I curiously became the first journalist in the world to do that. And the reason was that I had 15 years of credibility there. They knew I produced. They knew that I didn't get into trouble. They knew I got my facts straight, even if I can't keep my slides straight. And then there was a senior producer and an executive producer who didn't stand in the way and in fact, you know, gave encouragement. And so it can happen. And another thing is that it's important to be the media, as California producer and activist Penny Little puts it. And each of us, in fact, is a medium. Each of us is a walking, talking, thinking receiver and processor and transmitter of information and values. And we should never underestimate our own power and influence within our circle of loved ones and colleagues and friends and or in the community at large. Someone once said that the most important peace talks in the world take place over backyard fences. Now, coming to conclusion here, there are many anniversaries. An American social critic said, anniversaries are reservoirs of sacred power. The coming fifth anniversary of 9/11 represents an opportunity for the 9/11 truth movement. In the weeks and days leading up to the fifth anniversary of 9/11, those with a stake in perpetuating the official story of the events will be reinforcing the big lie. TV dramas and documentaries and newspaper and magazine articles will feature Arab fanatics and American victims and the brave resolve of the heroes of Flight 93 and all those conducting the war on terror. It will likely be an impressive propaganda onslaught. Already the made-for-TV Flight 93 and the last hour of Flight 11 have been aired in early 2006. I don't know, did any of you see those? Yeah, there you go, Hollywoodism. And such programming will dovetail with the official commemorations at Ground Zero and elsewhere. But for the 9/11 Truth Movement, all this provides opportunities to raise questions that members of the general public may not have considered, or maybe remind them of what they did consider but let slip out of their minds. And the very one-sidedness that can be expected from the mainstream media should be pointed out and effectively criticized at every opportunity. And smaller papers or TV stations may be willing to open the door to questions, especially if there's a local angle. And there are letters to the editor, again, that come into focus, and we can use the anniversary as a peg. It's your right, and if you're a 9/11 truth activist, it's your duty to do this outreach. One of the more effective campaigns these days, as far as organized political action on the 9/11 truth front is concerned, in my opinion, is Citizens Counter Coup, or 3C. And its formula, its slogan is the formula for change now. And you can find it on 911truth.org. Citizens Counter Coup, or 3C. Now, why work so hard to reveal the truth about 9/11? To many, the central importance of this is far from obvious. That's understandable. I've been asked, for instance, if there are not larger issues, such as peak oil, resource depletion in general, climate change, pollution, poverty, disease, injustice, civil liberties, and media reform that better deserve our attention, our time, and our money. Well, to begin with, activism for 9/11 truth is not an either-or proposition, and I applaud anyone pitching in on any worthy cause. I've chosen to focus on 9/11 truth for the rest of my life, but I find some time and money to support environmental, media democracy, and other causes as well. But working for 9/11 truth is, in my opinion, the single most effective way for me to work for all the other causes I support. Everything's relative. These other issues are diffuse and complex and widespread geographically and economically, whereas the events of 9/11, on the other hand, are relatively compact in time and space. Now, I've met people who would be willing to become involved in 9/11 truth activism but fear it will take too much time and that the time would be wasted. Well, everything's relative. As far as time is concerned, anyone can get up to speed on 9/11 far more quickly than on most other worthwhile causes. The crime of 9/11 is relatively accessible, understandable, and indeed provable. The literature on 9/11 is not nearly as daunting as that, for instance, on world poverty or the corporate takeover of the media. And additionally, the literature of 9/11 truth, including DVDs, frankly, is more fascinating in its own right than is the literature on those other important issues, in my opinion. 9/11 constitutes a crime mystery with historical, human, military, forensic, political, health, covert, psychological warfare, and other dimensions. And as for wasting time, well, that's always a risk when it comes to large causes. There's no guarantee we will win or that truth and justice will prevail. But nothing in the universe is wasted. Rather than being a waste, devoting oneself to a cause greater than oneself, win or lose, is one of the most important and meaningful time investments any person can make. As with other causes, there are people who say it's no use because the forces of the establishment are overwhelming. That's what's known as surplus powerlessness, or sometimes the counsel of despair. Surely we have to do what we can. Edmund Burke said, "Nobody made a greater mistake than he who did nothing, because he could do only a little." And I would add from life experience that you never know your luck. Repeatedly, I've seen seemingly lost causes, small and large, won. And in today's historical terms, the potential for rapid change, I think, is unprecedented. It could be that history is with us, and there's nothing as powerful as an idea whose time has come. The record crowds that demonstrated before the invasion of Iraq, which was unprecedented. The election of left-wing governments across Latin America. The worldwide antipathy to the U.S. military colossus. And other indicators show the world is getting ready for something better. It has been said there's a second superpower, world public opinion. Many are the signs that the second superpower is growing with a strength that is benign. We could be approaching a tipping point. Many of our elders are telling us that a new world is emerging. Eco-theologian Thomas Berry, in his book The Dream of the Earth, says, "It's all a question of story. We are in trouble just now because we do not have a good story. We are between stories. The old story, the account of how the world came to be and how we fit into it, is no longer effective. But we have not learned a new story." And Jean Houston, author of A Mythic Life, Learning to Live Our Greater Story, writes, Myth is important because we're at a time of the changing of the story. We're at the end of one era and not quite at the beginning of a new one. We do not see it yet, but we can feel a new story in our bones. The hound of heaven is going woof, woof, woof at our ankles in the morning. I think the new story will be the path followed once humankind finds the collective will to survive. Each person who comes to that consciousness is contributing what he or she can in a sustained way to the new dream of the earth. Thank you.
Barry Swicker, everyone.